right. I cannot believe how f***ed up America is right now. And I can't believe how a handful of men are successfully taking 50 years of rights away from women, and how a Supreme Court packed with abusers is just gonna sit by and let it all happen.
Actress Alyssa Milano in downtown LA on Saturday during one of hundreds of women's marches that took place around the country over the weekend. Demonstrators condemned Texas's near total ban on abortion and a Supreme Court that is growing more and more conservative when it comes to reproductive rights. On December 1st, the High Court hears oral arguments in a Mississippi case that could shape the future of abortion access in this country. And it's just one of the monumental cases the nine justices will consider during the court's new term, which kicks off today. Here to preview some of those cases is Jessica Levinson, Loyola Law School professor and our regular Legal Eagle here on Press Play. Hi.
Happy first Monday of the 2021 term, Madeline.
It is incredibly exciting and important. And of course, this Mississippi case is one that everyone's looking at that could be the one that overturns Roe v. Wade. Remind us of this case and the facts involved.
Yeah. So before Texas happened, we all thought we were just going to be talking about Mississippi when it came to abortion rights. And this really is, make no mistake, a full frontal attack on Roe v. Wade. It was designed to be an attack on Roe v. Wade. And this is a state law that essentially bans all abortions after 15 weeks. Now, why is that an attack on Roe versus Wade? Well, you know, back in the early 1970s, obviously, the court said there is a constitutionally protected right to have an abortion. Then in 1992, under our current case law, the case called Casey, the court said, okay, states, you can restrict a woman's access to obtain an abortion pre-viability, which is about 24 weeks, as long as that restriction isn't an undue burden. Now, Mississippi's law is not just a burden, it's a ban, and 15 weeks is obviously a lot less than 24 weeks. So that's why the Mississippi law and Roe are just at odds with each other. And honestly, I think after everything we've seen in Texas, the only question here will be, will the court have one of those lines that just lives in infamy forever, where they say Roe v. Wade is overturned? Or will they try and say, we're upholding this small part, the essential holding of Roe, but we're also upholding this Mississippi law and therefore just kind of hollow out and really somewhat eviscerate Roe?
So when they say undue burden, Mississippi is saying that 15 weeks is not an undue burden?
So Mississippi is frankly, I think, trying to say that, but I would say they acknowledge in some ways that this is at odds with Roe and Casey. And what this really is about is trying to overturn Roe. They do say the two can live together. They do use that undue burden language. But if we're to be serious about what an undue burden is, it can't mean that bans are acceptable. And that's why we might be seeing the court kind of engage in these type of linguistic gymnastics where they say, Roe says there's a right to an abortion. Well, there is still a constitutional right to an abortion, but it's just up to 15 weeks now.
Okay, so sticking with this topic, on Friday, a federal judge heard arguments from the Justice Department and lawyers from Texas over the federal request to block Texas's new abortion law that pretty much bans all abortions in the state. What happened on Friday?
So this is a really interesting hearing because it had to do a lot with whether or not the Department of Justice could basically even be in federal court making this argument. And the reason is because, as we've talked about, Texas designed its law so that a private person sues another private person for helping a woman to obtain an abortion or trying to help a woman obtain an abortion. And so what Texas is really arguing here is, look, we're not the ones enforcing this law. So why, Department of Justice, are you suing us? So in the arguments, Texas spent a lot of time saying basically not it, right? Why are you here? Why are you suing us? The state and state actors don't, in fact, enforce this law. And then you had the Department of Justice a bit arguing, no, we do belong here. And look, somebody in the state of Texas enforces this law. And for instance, they pointed to state court judges who would hear these cases. And then the Department of Justice really did spend some time saying, but let's be honest here. This Texas law, it goes against our federal precedent, and federal precedent is still supreme. So in a way, the arguments felt like ships passing in the night, but it will be really interesting to see whether or not this district court judge, in fact, imposes an injunction, which would mean stop the Texas law from going into effect, and what that would mean, because Texas said, well, sure, basically, okay, impose an injunction, but we're not the ones enforcing this. So there's just a lot of procedural, kind of this muddled morass of procedural stuff. And that's exactly what Texas wanted when they designed the law this way.
Okay, let's move on to another big case the Supreme Court will hear this fall on November 3rd. And this involves New York State trying to limit the ability of people to carry guns in public. Can you talk about this?
Yeah. If people haven't heard us talk about a gun control case in the Supreme Court or Second Amendment rights for a while, they're not imagining it. The court really hasn't addressed a big Second Amendment case for about a decade now. And some of the conservative justices have really complained about that. Basically, they made a big decision in 2008. The late Justice Antonin Scalia said, the Second Amendment is an individual right. You individuals hold it, not just the military. And ever since then, the court left a lot of other questions unanswered. This case picks up on some of those unanswered questions. And we're talking, as you said, about a New York law that restricts concealed carry permits and says you really have to have a good reason for asking for one of those permits. We know this is a 6-3 conservative court. If you look at the justices' decisions, they tend to be very suspicious of restrictions on gun ownership, and it could leave about 6 other states who have similar laws having to take those laws off the books.
Including here in California?
Including one here in California, exactly.
Okay, the day after tomorrow, on Wednesday, the court is taking up a case involving Abu Zubaydah. He's a Palestinian national accused of being an Al-Qaeda operative. He was captured back in 2002, and he's been in U.S. custody ever since. He was tortured at CIA black sites, and he's been at Guantanamo for about 15 years. And he has filed a lawsuit seeking information from the CIA contractors involved in his detention. What is this case about?
This case is about whether or not the federal government can say you don't get certain information in your lawsuit against the CIA contractors. The federal government has basically tried to say in this lawsuit, there are certain pieces of information, they're sensitive national security matters, and they fall within this so-called state secrets doctrine. And it does allow the government to withhold some information. The question is whether or not the court will say, okay, it includes this information. The Ninth Circuit in this case had rejected the government's argument. This court might look with more favor on the federal government's argument that no, we don't want to release this information in this particular litigation.
Okay, briefly, what are some of the other cases you're following this term?
Well, briefly, this is a big, big term. So there are a couple of cases that deal with religious rights. One case dealing with the rights of a death row inmate as to whether or not he can have his spiritual advisor, not just in the execution chamber, but if that spiritual advisor can actually put his hands on the death row inmate and pray audibly while they're in the chamber together. Another case dealing with a conservative group that wants to use a city's flagpole to fly their flag that has the Latin cross on it. There's some First Amendment cases that deal not with the freedom of religion, but with the freedom of speech, including one from Ted Cruz, who's challenging part of the federal election code. So this is already a packed term, and they haven't even set all of the cases that they're going to hear yet for oral arguments.
All right. Well, you will be back to explain them all, I am quite certain. And we're happy to have you. Jessica Levinson, Loyola Law School professor and our regular Legal Eagle here on Press Play. Thank you.
Thank you, Madeline.
So Some of the world's richest and most powerful people have some explaining to do today. Millions of newly released documents show how these people are able to shield billions from tax authorities and criminal investigators, using tax havens and shell companies to hide their vast wealth, sometimes in our own backyard, like in Malibu, where records show offshore companies linked to the King of Jordan spent $70 million on three adjacent homes overlooking the Pacific. The trove of confidential records is being called the Pandora Papers. The documents were obtained by the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, or ICIJ. The Washington Post has spent a year going through them, and joining us now to talk about this is Ziva Brandstetter. She was the lead editor for the Pandora Papers at the Post. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, let's talk about King Abdullah. He didn't just buy houses in Malibu. He has condos in D.C. He's got homes in London. Why is he doing this, investing in real estate in these countries?
Well, the Pandora Papers showed that Abdullah had spent around $106 million on lavish properties in Malibu, in London, and in Georgetown over about a decade period. And this was roughly the same time when the U.S. was providing aid to the tune of about a $1.6 billion, I think it was. A statement from the palaces, a law firm representing the palace, says that these homes are for security, that they own them in offshore ways to obscure ownership for the security of the monarch and his family. But the Pandora Papers show that the Abdullah went to great lengths to hide the true ownership of this property. So his offshore finance handlers would refer to him in a spreadsheet as you know who. And I don't see why, if you are thinking you're speaking in private to financial advisors, why would you refer to someone as you know? It's interesting.
Yeah. Is this legal here in the United States to have shell companies that are actually owned by a foreign head of state buying property here?
Yeah, there's no evidence that King Abdullah broke any laws, that he violated laws. There's also no evidence that the money spent on these properties came from USAID or even came from Jordan's tax dollars. All we know is that this sort of buying spree occurred during a period when they did receive the country did receive significant aid from the United States. And also at a time when some citizens in his country were suffering. There's a lot of wealth inequality in Jordan, and they've had some upheaval recently. So the story really looks at this sort of juxtaposition between these lavish properties. Some of them are near Buckingham Palace. Obviously the Malibu properties are in a very desirable location overlooking the ocean. Bluff top complexes. And, you know, it just raises the question about wealth inequality of sort of how the leader of this country wants to live and how many of his countrymen are living.
Who lives in these properties? Does he ever come himself and stay in them, or are they empty?
The Malibu places were under construction when we visited, and so there was no one in that property. The Georgetown properties, we have been told, were used for the Abdullah's daughters. His family, some of his adult children came and attended Georgetown. So that there were two condos and a very expensive property in DC. And then many properties in London. And apparently the King's family does like to go to London. And, you know, there's so many residents that is in the Kensington area. And, you know, the property, especially in London, is in some of the most valuable real estate in the world. There didn't appear to be anyone living in these properties when we visited, at any rate.
Another world leader, Russian President Vladimir Putin. We don't really know how much he's worth, but some estimate that he's worth well north of $100 billion. That's billion with a B. And there's not a lot in these papers concerning him specifically, but there is some information about a woman he's been linked to, according to the Russian media, potential girlfriend who is buying property. Tell us about her and what you learned.
Yes. Yeah, so the Pandora Papers show that a woman named Svetlana Krivonik, I probably messed that pronunciation up. She's 46 now, but that she became the owner of an apartment in Monaco through an offshore company created just weeks after she gave birth to a baby girl. This was about 18 years ago, that the child was born at a time when, according to Russian media report last year, she was in a secret years-long relationship with Putin. There is little about the humble background of, you know, this woman to indicate how she got this money. She grew up in a communal apartment in St. Petersburg. She held jobs that included cleaning up a neighborhood shop. And then, so all of a sudden, you know, she's giving birth to a child, and she's acquired at that time a $6 million Monte Carlo flat. Now it's worth probably in the neighborhood of $20
million. Wow. So talk a little bit about South Dakota as emerging as a friendly jurisdiction for a lot of this money. There's a one trust company in particular that has hundreds of billions of dollars in assets from people from all over the world. Why South Dakota?
Yeah, we were surprised at this. I mean, there's been a little bit of reporting about U.S. tax havens, but we really, you know, I think the U.S. does like to lecture smaller countries like the Bahamas, the Cayman Islands, and say, you know, get your act together. Their people are sort of sheltering their money in your tax shelters and your laws are too permissive. Well, what our investigation found is that the laws are just as permissive as if not more permissive in South Dakota and some of these other states. There are records in the Pandora Papers of 206 U.S.-based trusts, and about 88 of those were based in South Dakota. So we dug into how much due diligence are these South Dakota, you know, trust companies doing if this is all secret. They don't have to, there's no transparency in this process. That's the problem. And we found, you know, lots of people who had been connected to sort of troubling behavior. There was, you know, a Colombian textile magnate who was caught in a scheme to launder the proceeds of an international drug ring. There was an orange juice mogul who settled with authorities over, you know, price fixing. And it raises a question of what kind of wealth do we want to be sheltering in the United States? What kind of standards should these companies have for due diligence? Should it only be you can't take money from criminals, or should there be more sort of steeper requirements?
What does South Dakota get out of it?
Well, that's the funny thing. We found that the trust industry had really kind of captured that state legislature. The line was, well, we're going to get jobs. We're going to get money. It's going to bring money and jobs. It brought about 400 jobs and very, very little money. So this, there was a trade-off of possibly your honor, I guess, as a state for a situation that's not really creating any wealth for the state. And it's a poor state, too.
Hmm. Well, there's a ton more information at the Washington Post in the Pandora Papers. Ziva Brandstetter was lead editor for that series at the Washington Post. Ziva, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up, how marine life is being affected by that big oil spill off Huntington Beach. It could take a while to clean up. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. More than 126,000 gallons of crude oil spilled into the Pacific Ocean over the weekend. Orange County officials blamed a damaged pipeline off the coast of Newport Beach and Huntington Beach. So far, we don't know the full extent of the damage, but already birds and marine life are suffering and dying. Michael Zaccardi, director of the Oiled Wildlife Care Network, said this at a press conference this morning.
Typically, spills of this nature, we're here for several weeks to months, continuing to respond to animals and respond to calls from animals that may be out there. So it's really too early to tell.
So what will this cleanup effort look like? Joining us now is Peter Chang, Chief Executive Officer of the Pacific Marine Mammal Center in Laguna Beach. Welcome.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, happy to have you. Well, there is just a haven of marine wildlife off our coast. Have we seen if the spill has harmed big marine mammals like dolphins and whales and seals yet?
Well, we haven't seen quite the impact yet, which is not unusual. These things can take up to a few days before these larger animals start getting very impacted by these, by the oil spills, and when they start showing up on shores is likely a couple days from now.
Mm. And how do they react in general, these bigger marine mammals like dolphins, for example? Do they swim quickly to get out of the spill and try to save themselves?
Yeah, they. So it depends on the type of marine mammal. So some of them can react good if they, you know, the oil tends to bubble up to the surface. Some of it does go down into the different columns of the water, different depths of the water. If they're able to stay down low, they'll be in a good place. So elephant seals that tend to be deep divers, offshore animals, they'll probably be better off than sea lions and harbor seals and dolphins. They tend to be up at the surface a little bit more. And what we have to worry about is different for the different animals. We have to worry about kind of ingestion and inhalation of the oil that can impact respiratory systems of these animals. And there's a lot of unknown that we're still trying to figure out. They are still gathering the knowledge base for what happened with Deep Horizon, which was years ago, and then with kind of the pinnipeds, the animals that have the fur, like the seals and sea lions, the concern is a lot of the concern is with the external issues. If the oil coats their fur, it's going to prevent the fur from fur from doing its job in terms of keeping the animal warm. And so a lot of times when the oil drenches these animals, they'll go into hypothermia, and they will literally freeze to death.
Oh, wow. Well, so how can your organization or others who want to help, how can they help these sea lions and the other animals recover?
So right now, with oil spills and oil responses, it's highly regulated. Volunteers are required to be specifically trained by the Oiled Wildlife Care Network. However, inevitably, there'll be different functions that we'll need help with that are not directly involved with the oil response. So we're currently taking down names and contacts for people that do want to get involved so that when the time comes, we can put a call out for these folks to come in and help. Currently, we're doing a lot of staging right now. The response is going to happen in a couple of days, but we want to prepare for that. So we're getting all the supplies ready. We have a bunch of things that we have on our wish list that we're going to need. We're also being supportive to the other agencies. So we're collecting supplies for instance, the Huntington Beach Wetlands and Wildlife that currently does not have that much space to hold the supplies. So check out our wish list. Also, we're taking in financial donations to purchase supplies that we're going to need down the road in the very short future. It is a marathon, not a sprint, so we are taking it day by day.
Yeah. Well, how would people contact you? What's your web address?
Our website is www.pacificm.org. Our phone number also is 949-494-3050. Please also follow us on our social media, @PacificMMC. We're putting out a lot of updates on there as well as our wish list. Mm-hmm. Between those three, you'll be able to reach us.
How many animals are you expecting you're going to have to try to treat?
Oh geez, we don't know. What we're doing is we're hoping for the best, preparing for the worst, but we just don't know. We have the tricky thing with the oil response. Once you use the supplies on one particular animal, you pretty much can't use those supplies anymore because the oil doesn't come off. So you have to really take off and throw away all of that gear and all those supplies. And for the next response, you have to use a whole new set of supplies. So it's going to take a lot of resources, but we don't know quite yet what to expect. We have about 15 to 20 people that are trained by the Oiled Wildlife Care Network. And so it does seem like a lot, but when in a couple of days when we start getting the calls, those resources could be used up pretty fast. So we just don't know what to expect right now, but we're trying to prepare for the worst.
Peter Chang, CEO of the Pacific Marine Mammal Center in Laguna Beach, thank you and good luck helping those animals.
Thank you.
Coming up, one of Hollywood's biggest unions authorizes a nationwide strike for the first time.
There are hundreds and hundreds of productions around the country right now that will be impacted by this if the producers do not come back to the table with a counteroffer.
That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. An overwhelming majority of one of Hollywood's biggest unions voted to authorize a nationwide strike today. 98% of those who cast votes voted in favor. The union is the International Association of Theatrical Stage Employees, or IATSE, and it represents around 60,000 below-the-line workers, hair and makeup artists, lighting, sound crews, camera operators. Members have complained of long hours, few breaks, and low wages. Joining us to talk about this vote are two guests, Andy Kennedy Durkay. He's a second assistant camera person and member of IATSE. Welcome back to the show, Andy.
Hey.
Also joining us is David Robb, labor editor for Deadline Hollywood. Welcome back, David.
Thank you.
And Dave, the results show that 90% of those who eligible union voters cast ballots with more than 98% supporting an authorization. Did you expect this? This is huge.
Yeah, it's really big. Only about 700 out of 53,000 people voted no. Only about 700. Everybody else is strongly in favor of going on a strike if they can't get a fair deal.
Right. So it doesn't mean they will go on strike, but what is the likelihood, do you think, that they will?
Well, they are going to return to the bargaining table, hopefully this week, and there's a very good chance that they can work out a deal. IATSE has never had a nationwide strike, and this would be the first, so we'll have to see.
Andy, what do you think? Do you think there's a good chance that you'll avert a strike?
I really hope so, that we're, from what I understand, we're returning to the table tomorrow. The telecom companies which make up AMPTP are well aware of what our offers are, and they're more than reasonable. And with this strike authorization vote, which is very historic, they have to see that we are united in placing these issues as a mandate for change.
Right. So this is a huge bargaining chip, and AMPT is the Alliance of Motion Pictures and Television Producers. Dave, any response from them to this vote?
Yeah, they issued a statement saying that they remain committed to returning to the bargaining table. They think a deal can still be reached. That's what they said.
Okay. Andy, remind us what your union wants.
So what the what IATSE is asking for, we are negotiating the basic agreement that governs most of the television and film production that is done in this country and in Canada, that we are asking for the establishment of a weekend turnaround, that currently there is nothing that protects workers from working until 6 a.m. on Saturday and then coming back at 6 a.m. to start work on Monday after 70, 75 hours of work. We want to establish a weekend, the first basic agreement weekend turnaround, which would be about 52 hours, which would still allow people to work until 4 a.m. on Saturday and come back at 8 a.m. on Monday. We are asking for a living wage for all members of the union. Currently, there are members of 871, which represents script coordinators and writer's assistants and script supervisors. There are members who make $15 to $17 an hour. That is really unreasonable for the hours that they are asked to work and the accountability at all hours of the day that they're expected to keep. We're asking for a restructuring of meal penalties and increased meal penalties. Currently, there's been a 77% deflationary decrease in how powerful a meal penalty is. A meal penalty is if you get to working 6 hours, how you are compensated if you are not broken. A lot of shows during COVID have been working 14 hours straight and just eating the meal penalties and not allowing people a break to step outside, take a mass break, have something to eat. And our jobs are go, go, go. And so while AMPTP wants us to go to rolling lunches where we call our own lunch, but many of us can never go on lunch, we are asking for increased penalties, which have not changed since the late 80s. And we're also asking for a changing in the designation of what the contract calls new media, that we established some side letter contracts in the advent of streaming media that allowed television to be produced for Netflix, et cetera, when it still wasn't this vibrant economic sphere that it has become today. And AMPTP has held on to those contracts, saying that it's still experimental when we're making The Mandalorian, we're making these incredibly expensive television shows, which are no different than things made for the major networks. And mm-hmm. so they don't pay into our pensions at the same rate that others do. They don't give residuals at the same rate. And I think that it's time to give away, to do away with new media as a deferential designation from traditional television and film.
So out of that list, David, what does AMPTP object to the most?
Well, everything. They the union has cast this as a human rights issue. Longer rest periods, a reduction of the really brutal work hours, 14, 16-hour days. They want livable wages for the lowest paid workers. AMPTP has agreed to like a 25% increase for the lowest paid workers. They've agreed to talk about the streaming projects, but the companies are in a bind because they need to turn around films and TV shows quickly so that other actors and directors can get onto their next projects. So it's a tough spot that both sides are in to reduce the number of hours and yet still have enough work for everybody to do so that they can get onto their next projects.
So, Andy, the last time there was a huge strike in this town, it was the writer's strike back in 2008. It lasted nearly 4 months. How long are you prepared to sit out, to not work?
I can only speak for myself. I think that the mm-hmm. membership voting in the way that they did would also show solidarity with this, that I'm willing to sit out for as long as it takes to get more reasonable working conditions. And it's the casting that that there will be a reduction in hours with a fair deal contract being put in place. We're not putting any limits on working 14-hour days. That's not on the table in this contract. And so it's just a matter of being compensated for those infringements on your health and safety that allow people to make enough funds to step away if their health and safety are being threatened. That while we do need to change the culture of working 16 hours, that's and I wish that those things were being changed in this contract, those are still going to be a part of filmmaking. And so however, the writer's strike was seen coming months in advance. I don't think that the AMPTP expected this unified front of local of IOTC workers saying that they are willing to go on strike. So hopefully it will be resolved very quickly.
Okay, let's hope so. Andy Kennedy Durkay, camera person and member of IOTC. David Robb is labor editor for Deadline Hollywood. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, the LA Opera is back. We'll talk about what opening night was like with one of the stars next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. That is the Anvil Chorus from the LA Opera production of Giuseppe Verdi's Il Trovatore. It premiered last month, and it is the first show from the LA Opera since the pandemic began. But getting to opening night came with a lot of challenges. The set pieces were stuck at sea, thanks to a major backlog at the ports. And so the company had to build a whole new set in just 10 days. The show did go on and continues to go on. And joining us now is Christopher Kelch. He is CEO and president of the LA Opera. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you. And Rayanne Bryce Davis. She's a performer in the opera. She plays Azucena in Il Trovatore. Hi.
Hi, so great to speak with you today.
Great to have you too. All right, well, let's talk about all of the difficulties you had to surmount getting to opening day and talk a little bit, Christopher, if you would, about the situation with the set. What happened?
Well, as one of the many knock-on effects of our lingering pandemic is just the port congestion, labor shortages at the port. And so as has been reported extensively, there are, you know, many dozens of ships that are stranded outside the port of Los Angeles. And so it only became clear to us, frankly, very late in the process that we would miss our arrival date. And when that happens, it starts a unfortunate series of domino effects. And so we sprung into Plan B.
Right. And so how did you do that so quickly, create an entire set in just 10 days?
Well, all credit really goes to our incredible team of stagehands. And I think of this as being part and parcel of COVID in a way. I mean, we were all so excited, frankly, to be back together and creating together. And we weren't going to let anything stop us. And so while it seemed, in theory, impractical, we have all of this kind of pent-up energy, all of this pent-up skill. And in a way, it was kind of an incredible morale boost for everyone in the company to show that no matter what the impediments were, and there have been legions of impediments over the past 18 months, that we were going to make this happen for our community of artists, and for ourselves. It was really, really important.
Rayanne, what was it like for you, first of all, rehearsing without the set pieces?
Well, the team actually got the set pieces ready for when we were on stage, when we started rehearsals on stage. So we barely even noticed all of the drama happening behind the scenes. Huh. We were in the rehearsal space, and in that space, they always just have replicas of things. So we were very happy playing with our toy swords and things before getting to the big stage. So we didn't even notice. By the time we got to the stage, everything was looking fantastic, exactly as we had seen it before in the previous production. So we were just in complete awe of the job that the team had done.
And what about the idea of performing for the first time in 18 months in front of a live audience inside?
Oh, I mean, this is the dream. This is what we've trained all our lives to do and what we've been dying to do all of this time. We've been able to create some innovative works that weren't really on the horizon previously. But this was my first time back in a full time on the big stage with the set and the fire and the excitement. And when we perform, when we rehearse, it's a different show from when there are bodies in the seats. So the excitement was just palpable, and I was so in awe to be able to share music again with people.
The thing that we have been missing so much is that ineffable, acute exchange of energy. Mm-hmm. And being robbed of that feeling for 18 months, you have a renewed sense of gratitude for it because of its absence. And the thing that has been laid bare to me is, again, that kind of that palpable sense of that exchange of energy and how much that improves the experience for both the audience and for the artist. And then it feeds on each other. It's in dialogue mm-hmm. with one another. And, you know, I don't want to speak for Rianne, but I watched her performance transform when there were actual people in the room to receive it.
How is that for you? Like, can you describe the opening night, for example, and the curtain goes up and there you are. And for the first time, there's an audience. Maybe you can't see them because of the lights, but you can feel them.
You know, I actually can see them. And it was just a completely different experience. As we were saying, when you're recording, you can kind of do as many takes as you want, as you can afford. And you have a chance to say like, no, I want this note to be exactly this color. And now I want this note to be exactly this, you know, whatever, and make it as perfect and canned as you can. But then when you get to the big stage and there's only this moment, there's only this breath, there's only this phrase to tell this story. And there's something very exciting about that. And this is the magic of opera. It's only the human voice, unamplified. And it's kind of the greatest that humanity can offer, all of our artistic outpouring in that moment. And the curtain goes up and I don't sing immediately. I'm just standing there in this moment in the silence, but I feel the audience and I feel their excitement. Before the curtain even went up, we made announcements about, you know, just turning off your cell phones, very regular announcements. But it started with, it's so good to be back, isn't it? And the audience just went wild. And I couldn't even see them. They were still behind the curtain, but I was like, whoa, they're really there. We're really in this moment together. And it was really emotional, actually. I had to be like, pull it together, Rianne, pull it together. You have to perform.
Well, let's hear a little bit of you now as we chain that. This is from Act Two. About your character, who is she, Azucena, and what is she saying there?
Oh, Azucena is a mother. She is a daughter. And she has endured extreme trauma. She has seen her mother burned at the stake. And that singular experience has been transformational, and her entire mission of her life is to avenge her mother, avenge the wrong that was done to her. She was so completely lost in her trauma that she accidentally throws her own child into the fire in an attempt to avenge him instead of the son of the count who had been responsible for murdering her mother. That is the extent of her trauma. And so she is just caught in this circle of trying to avenge the wrong that was done. And that is her singular focus throughout the entire evening. And she tries to have her quote unquote son, Manrico, who is actually the son of the count, to do this for her, to avenge her mother. And so we see this circle happening over and over in the show.
Hmm. Christopher, why did you choose this opera to be the first opera of the season post-lockdown?
Well, interestingly, this had been planned many years ago. I mean, we have a kind of cadence of kinds of varieties of repertory we try to represent. This happens to be a piece, really a cornerstone of the repertory that we hadn't performed in 15 years. So the plans for this were laid many years ago. And in fact, it was slated to open our 2020-2021 season. And so one of the great gifts, frankly, of reorganizing was that we were able to just lift the entire fall repertory and just postpone it a year. That has many benefits, not the least of which was that our audience was so excited to be able to hear this great work again, but also because it allowed us to maintain our obligations, frankly, to our artists and to our audience for them to hear these artists sing this incredible work.
Rand, the themes of this opera, obviously they're timeless, but in a particular way, it seems to me, they are resonant with what we're talking about politically in this country now in terms of the widening gap between the rich and the not rich, and that this is also a story of class and a story of race as well.
Absolutely. I mean, Azucena and her Roma community are certainly the have-nots. And the fact that her mother was able to be put to death only because, you know, this count said, oh, she was looking at my child. And therefore, that's why he was sick, because she bewitched him, you know, and with just that word, he was able to end her life. And so that is certainly a huge theme. You can see the entitled count versus this community that is completely at their mercy and are striving so hard to do things outside of the law possibly to get that justice. And certainly in our production, you can almost see that more clearly because it's such an amazingly diverse cast. We have some of the great Black singers of today, Morris Robinson, Limmy Pulliam making a huge debut. In some of the smaller roles, we have Tiffany Townsend and Orson Van Gay, which, you know, it's so exciting for me as a Black singer. I'm usually kind of the only one in the room. And so just to have that community on stage is so powerful as well. And so you actually see some of these differences on stage, which isn't usually the case. Usually there's a lot more imagination that needs to take place, but you see some of these disparities on stage in our production, and just the questions of justice with the Black Lives Matter movement is seen very clearly in this production.
Christopher, was the Black Lives Matter movement and all of the racial reckoning that came out of the killing of George Floyd, did that influence the casting of this opera?
I mean, it's influenced every decision I think that every artistic institution is making. I mean, the LA Opera has had a longstanding commitment to making sure that the representation on the stage is reflective of the LA community. But, you know, I think there's a sense sometimes that these institutions exist outside of a society and are not directly reflective of it. Even an opera company, which is in general looking back at historical repertory more than it's engaged more fully in contemporary repertory, that we have something to say and to contribute to the dialogue around racial inequities and economic and class inequities in this country.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for being here. And I want to go out on another piece from this show. This is Di Quella Pira, and it's performed by Limmy Pulliam. And you mentioned him, Ryan, earlier. He plays your son. Can you talk a little bit about this character and what we might be hearing?
So Limmy is an exciting young tenor, and it's so exciting to share the stage with him. Oddly, in our production, although he is my son, Azucena's love is poured toward this kind of physicalization of her dead child. And so her relationship with Manrico on stage is much more complicated, and she's just focused on his having revenge. But he has his own full life. He's in love. He keeps getting in conflicts with the count. And this is his big finale, his big triumphant moment singing one of the great arias of opera that Limmy does so splendidly.
I want to thank you both so much for being here. Rayanne Bryce Davis, she plays Azucena in Il Trovatore. Also, she's the co-founder of the Black Opera Alliance. And Christopher Kelch is CEO and president of the LA Opera. And the production of Il Trovatore runs through October 10th. You can live stream the show this Wednesday, October 6th. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
And that does it for us today on Press Play. Thank you for listening. I'm Madeline Brand, and I'll see you tomorrow.